Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. It has been a truly FUBAR week for the Trump administration, who this week accepted the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn in the wake of an unfolding investigation into Flynn's contacts with Russian officials, whether or not he told the truth about them, and the extent to which entanglements with the Russian government can be found throughout Trump's political organization. Add to that the recurring theme of a quiet war between the White House and the intelligence community, and the worries only get wider. But how alarmed should we be? We're going to try to find out. Meanwhile, one of the more interesting things about Trump advisor Steve Bannon is that when he talks about the 2008 financial crisis, he can sound, well, a little like us, to be honest. At least up to a point. But there is an observable place at which our points of view diverge. And one person who has noticed this is journalist and author Thomas Frank, who joins us today to talk about this. Finally, as the Democrats rebuild themselves after the 2016 election, they've been debating the extent to which they need to shift their political priorities and alter a philosophy whose usefulness has seemingly expired. One way in which the Democrats could obviously reform themselves is to end their codependent relationship with Wall Street. But are they smart enough to do this? One person who is skeptical is The Week's Ryan Cooper, who joins us to talk about his recent piece on the matter. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Jessica Schulberg. Here's what happened first. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's So That Happened, your favorite podcast, I'm assuming. Should be. I hope it is. My name is Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press at the Huffington Post. Boy, everything just continues to happen, and there's never going to be an end to it. And so many things we're not going to cover today because we can't cover everything anymore. It's impossible. But giving it the good college try, we have Zach Carter.
You know, I think it would be good if things never ended, right?
I don't know.
I'm anti-Ragnarok. I'm anti-apocalypse.
Oh, Ragnarok is a fun thing. You should not look. Ragnarok
is like
good.
Burning Man.
We all go to Valhalla, and we never want for booze ever again.
Who else is here?
Ragnarok is good. Arthur Delaney is not here. He is on.
I'm not Arthur.
I know he's not. He's on staycation. Mm. And so if you're a big Arthur Delaney fan, there's nothing we can do for you. But we're doing our best. And I think I would recommend our guest Jessica Schulberg as a perfectly great alternative to Arthur Delaney. Jessica, what do you think?
You make me sound like a consolation guest.
You're not a consolation guest. Maybe you're a challenge to Arthur's hegemonic
supremacy,
appeal.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe this is it.
I think
Arthur.
I'll be honest. I think for this particular week, Jessica is a much more important guest than Arthur would have been. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, man. Because this has been the week of Flynn sanity.
That's pretty clever. Did you just come up with that?
I literally probably did come up with it and also stole it from about 15,000 other people who said this on Twitter.
Oh.
Michael Flynn, he is out of a job. This is the man who we once described with you in our presence as probably the most terrifying person on Trump's foreign policy team. And yet I am not sleeping as well as I thought I would hearing this news, because of the ongoing contretemps between Donald Trump, insane orange megalomaniac, and the deep state, people who spy and lie for a living, ostensibly to protect us, but they're unelected. And so we have this, like, I feel like we're probably moving into some very dark waters.
I think that's fair. The circumstances of Flynn's departure are not reassuring.
Crazily enough, Moby, knew about all of this.
Did you ever end up writing that piece?
No, but Moby put on Facebook like a bunch of stuff he thought was going to happen. And so far, he's doing
Not that he thought, that he knew. Because he went to Washington. He talked to people in Washington, and he knows what's going on.
This is Moby, the electronic musician.
He developed a lot of intelligence community contacts while he was scoring the Bourne trilogy movies, obviously. And they talked to Moby at his tea shop in Manhattan. So the upshot, Michael Flynn has had apparently questionable, perhaps sanctionable conversations with Russian officials.
I did not have sanctionable relations with those officials.
Right. I thought you said sexual.
Sanctionable.
Sanctionable. I totally missed that, man. I could catch up. I'll be right back.
We don't know how deep this goes. Hopefully it doesn't end there.
That's next week's non-zero chance of everything.
And he lied to at least Mike Pence.
Poor Mike Pence.
About this. And so he's out of a job. And that's rightly so, correct?
But let me point out, he's not out of a job because he discussed sanctions policy with the Russian ambassador, potentially undermining Obama's policy while Obama was still the president. He's not out of a job because then he lied to the vice president about it and made him look like a jackass on TV. He's out of a job because all this became public. Donald Trump knew about the investigations by the FBI and the NSA into these phone calls. There was intercepted communications. Donald Trump was briefed on it. He didn't bother telling Mike Pence, like, hey, this guy made you go on TV and lie. He didn't bother firing Flynn until there was an escalating series of news reports that were spilling all these details out into the public.
And the details have gotten even more significant since then. We have the New York Times reporting that members of Trump's campaign were in constant contact with
that was CNN, I think, the constant.
Sorry, yeah, it was CNN, not New York Times. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, everyone has their bit of the apple. Zach?
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess for Jess, my question is, you know, what should we be – what should the public be concerned about or be interested
Everything.
In here at this stage? I mean, this is – so you have Flynn resigning, you know, sort of forced resignation. Mm-hmm. You have these other people like Paul Manafort, Carter Page, who –
Roger Stone.
Who are not involved officially in the Trump administration because of believed contacts with Russia. What does this mean?
I think the biggest remaining unanswered question about Flynn's contacts with Ambassador Kislyak, I mean, none of this is surprising. Like him calling the ambassador on the day that Obama sanctions the Russian intelligence community, Flynn calling him and perhaps delivering a message that says, don't worry, like we're going to take care of this later. Not terribly surprising. What still hasn't come out into the open is just how many people in the Trump administration were involved in this or knew about this. It's sort of hard to believe that Flynn really acted as this like total rogue character within the administration when this is so in line with behavior that we've seen from the campaign in the past. And as Zach was getting at, there's at least four people who are being investigated by the FBI, by the broader law enforcement intelligence community, for having contacts with Russian intelligence officials in the year leading up to the campaign. So it's not like this just came out of nowhere. It's just what reporters have managed to get the most specific leaked details on.
John Schindler, former NSA analyst who now writes for Observer, has suggested in Observer that the spies have gone to war with the Trump administration. And obviously you now see Trump pursuing several simultaneous lines of attack on the story, one of which has been to attempt to make the case that the entirety of the intelligence agencies have gone rogue against a legitimately elected president. To what extent should we be thinking about this in terms as like a deep state versus executive branch ordeal?
It's a good question because it's easy for liberals or really anybody who's bothered by Trump to sort of relish in seeing Trump or Trump spokesman Sean Spicer get up and say, we have never had any contact with Russians ever. And Paul Manafort, who is like publicly like best known for helping a pro-Russian Ukrainian politician get elected, this guy is going out and saying, I've never had any contacts directly or indirectly with Russians. It's like, give me a break. So it's sort of satisfying to see the intelligence community being like, well, that's some bullshit. And then leak it to reporters who sort of correct the narrative. But as you pointed out, that does speak to a broader problem where we do have these people who operate in the shadows. They they are not elected. Historically, the left has been very critical of them sort of operating with very little oversight. And the idea of an intelligence community acting like rogue in a rogue way against a democratically elected president would be terrifying. I think the question here is, who are you more afraid of and who do you trust less, Donald Trump or the intelligence community? And I don't have an answer to that.
You know, it's worth pointing out that if you're getting a little bit too geeked up about what the IC is doing to Donald Trump, you should remember it was the same people who essentially made sure that everyone found out about Hillary Clinton's emails. So, you know, this works both ways. And I feel like I said, I expected to feel a little bit better, sleep a little bit better at night, knowing that Flynn was gone. I don't know what to think about this. Obviously,
you might say that you're just sort of a little bit one state, two state.
Oh, you want to transition
about it, right?
You want to transition. I am a one state, two state, and I don't want to take away from the idea that
Arab state, Jewish state.
Whatever
it's been great,
makes Dr. You happy,
Seuss
whatever
book.
They like.
No less a threat are, of course, Russian intelligence agents in this. But yeah. So in addition to what's been going on with Flynn, the thing that's, you know, we should pay attention to everything. And obviously, by the time you hear this, the story may have changed significantly. Another big foreign policy moment that Zach was alluding to really, really subtly, I almost didn't pick it up, is that Donald Trump did a one-on-one with Bibi Netanyahu this week, and the great decider couldn't figure out if you preferred a one or two state solution in that region.
It's whatever they like, whatever makes you happy. Right. I will point out that just before
he's running things like a businessman,
right? I will point out that just before stepping in to record this, Nikki Haley, I saw on Twitter, said that the U.S. is absolutely committed to a two-state solution.
Oh,
I will say that
memo.
Nikki Haley has absolutely zero power in this administration. But more broadly, what I would say about our Israel policy that will be completely relevant for the next 4 years, I imagine, is that we have none. It's completely all over the place. I mean, every time Trump gets out there and says something, or some anonymous White House official says something, I get texts from people at the State Department be like, oh, they didn't consult with us on that. They didn't consult with us. Oh, that's on our policy. And then the next day you see somebody else going out and saying something that's completely the opposite. I mean, we would never see that type of just blatant contradiction day to day from members of the same administration before. This is mind-blowing.
So is it – I don't mean to be too pessimistic here or too cynical, but I mean, there are people on Twitter, people in the intelligentsia saying that this, you know, whatever Trump says, by just sort of waffling, shrugging his shoulders about the two-state solution, that means that it's basically dead. But was it really alive before that?
No, it was very dead. A story that I never actually wrote but should have was I interviewed several Palestinian activists and former Palestinian negotiators when Trump was first elected, and said, you know, like, how do you feel about this? He's nominating this man, David Friedman, who's an outspoken critic of a Palestinian state. He's pro-settlements. Jared Kushner's donated money to settlement organizations. Like, we're never going to see a two-state solution, and there won't even be this sort of consistent American pressure on Israel to work towards this kind of, like, vague, seemingly unattainable goal. And most of the Palestinians I spoke to were like, great, like, there hasn't been a Palestinian state in years. Like, where are you going to have a Palestinian state? Like, how do you really think that Israel is really going to give us that? Like, what we need to work towards now is having equal rights on whatever sort of binational state exists, so that we don't have apartheid. And if we do have apartheid, then it'll be a lot easier to call out for what it is when the U.S. is no longer pretending that this is sort of this limbo period as we work towards an eventual Palestinian state.
So everything's going to be fine.
That's one way to look at it.
So Trump did say in front of everybody, he turned to Bibi and he said, I'd like to see you cool it on the settlements. Does that mean anything in a public setting?
I think it means as much as past U.S. proclamations of cool it on the settlements have been. I think normally Obama wouldn't just say that off the cuff in a presser. They would make a statement after that's like, I've informed Israel that, you know, settlements are not helpful towards reaching a two-state solution. So I wouldn't take
it. Is that
it,
your Obama
that
impression?
It's not very good. I'm getting it mixed with my Trump impression.
Okay, so there's one way in which you're a little bit inferior to Arthur, but we'll look past that. It's okay. It's okay. Continue.
I think what was interesting about that statement is it sort of appeared like he just sort of said that and Beebe wasn't expecting it. You know, they hadn't necessarily sat down and like talked through all the issues and then had like, you know, this is what we came out of. It sort of seemed like off the cuff. He was just like, oh, yeah, by the way, like, cool it. Which I will point out is completely contradictory to what he said, I think, last year, I think towards the end of the year, where he said Israel should go forward and build more settlements. It was almost as if he was like in a construction mogul again. He's like, let's just keep building in the West Bank, like go for it.
It's almost as if he doesn't understand this issue
and
doesn't know what he's talking about.
It
also doesn't really care to learn this issue. To briefly jump back to the Flynn situation, obviously the way you could resolve a conflict between the executive branch and the intelligence community is for Congress to do something about it. Congress ostensibly oversees all of this. Well, you laugh, but okay. All right, maybe I've gotten completely out over my skis, but there are some.
Tell me more of how you envision this congressional oversight over the Republican president and the intelligence community.
Laura Barrón-López and I did report about how, at least in the Senate, you have some prominent Republicans who chair powerful committees willing to look into at least the matter of Flynn. And on the other side, you have, of course, Trump-aligned Republicans in the House who want to pursue a leak investigation and perhaps bring
Devin Nunes.
Right. Yeah. Jason Chaffetz and Devin Nunes. And now Trump has appointed some private equity guy to apparently overhaul the entire intelligence community, which I'm sure they'll go along with. Is any of this, do you think, is leading anywhere where we perhaps settle these scores? Properly oversee and get to the crux of what wrongdoing was taken and move on?
I think that is a long ways away, potentially even years. I mean, the Benghazi committee is a bad example. The 9/11 commission is a better example of like
that
a fact-finding thing
years.
That took 2.5 years. I think it's a good sign that we're seeing some Republican senators take this seriously. John McCain, Lindsey Graham, I guess Marco Rubio.
Blunt. Yeah.
Burr kind of dragged his feet on this one. I'm giving him half of a shout out.
Corker's
been a little more aggressive.
The House Republicans have just explicitly, like six different committees, have explicitly voted against oversight for the Trump administration.
Who was it that specifically said we don't need to investigate Flynn because this is all taken care of itself?
That was Chaffetz.
Profile and courage right there.
Right. my point was going to be that I think it is a good sign that some Republicans are coming around on this. I do think it's going to become increasingly an untenable political position for Republicans to keep protecting Trump from this. The more, as it will inevitably happen, the more leaks that come out about who in his campaign has done what sketchy thing with the Russian government. I think eventually we're going to see more Republicans jump ship. My question is how thorough the investigations are, how much they're just for show. The most substantial substantive ones will be in the House and the Senate Intelligence Committees, where a lot of the work can be done behind closed doors, which is important but doesn't really give the public kind of a factual accounting of what happened. So I think that's a lot of what still remains to be seen.
This story,
I don't think Arthur could have said that.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, good job.
But he could have said a dumbed down version of Trump voice.
Yeah, maybe.
He could have told a funny joke.
So this story obviously is not going to disappear as much as Trump would like it to. Is it? Are we getting out over our skis to like suggest that we're into a full blown constitutional crisis?
Well,
I worry that we're also wired to freak out that we're just going to start saying things that aren't necessarily true.
Really, I feel like I'm like losing my ability to freak out. I feel like everything. I'm like, yeah, that sounds like pretty standard insanity.
I guess I'll write a story
about it if Sam really wants me to.
Let's not give Sam any ideas.
constitutional crisis, we talked about this a lot when you saw Trump going on Twitter and yelling about the, quote, so-called judge who wouldn't reinstate his travel ban. And then, you know, the obvious fear of that is he's basically suggesting that a federal judge who was appointed by a Republican president isn't legitimate and that his decision shouldn't be respected, which worst case scenario sort of sends a wink, wink, nod, nod to law enforcement to continue enforcing his travel ban, even though the courts have ruled against him. And that, I would say, is the definition of a constitutional crisis, is where a judge's ruling is basically disregarded by the executive branch.
Right. Once again, it would take Congress to settle that issue.
Keep the dream alive, Jason.
Yeah, the dream is on life support. All right, Jessica, you were great.
I'm sorry I wasn't Arthur.
You know what? I didn't miss Arthur one bit.
I missed Arthur a little.
Yeah, well, you're
I didn't.
You're alone in that.
Hi, Arthur.
You have one fan.
Sorry, Arthur. You just got fired.
Arthur will obviously be back next week.
You've been replaced by Lou Gehrig.
Yes. But thanks for being on, Zach. Thank you. You're going to be on, obviously, more because Arthur isn't here.
Yeah, I'll see you guys in like 20 seconds.
Yeah. We have a great show, so stick around. We will be right back.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And we are back. And as always, we come back to a world in which the 2008 financial crisis looms over everything. And it's the big lesson to be taken from every part of politics these days. No less a time is now where it's relevant. Joining us to talk a little bit about this, Zach Carter.
He's here. Everybody.
He's here. You know he's here because Arthur's not. We can't sub Zach out for Arthur.
Nope.
Yep. You're stuck with Zach this whole podcast, and you're stuck with me this whole podcast. This segment, you're also stuck with our good friend and fellow Virginia Cavalier, Thomas Frank. Welcome back.
Yep, good to be here.
You are back, sir. You must be doing
in a manner of speaking.
You must be doing something right, man. I hope you take this as a sign that your work is being honored and cherished. We wanted to talk about something you recently wrote. We were talking about Steve Bannon and his sort of eschatological worldview.
Yes.
Last week, and one of the things we mentioned is that as nutball as Bannon is, there's this element where he sort of sees the world in a sort of similar way to Zach and I, properly informed by a massive financial crisis that happened, which ground ordinary people up in the gears of it. And you've recently written about that, specifically about Bannon's worldview on the financial crisis. And I know you have something sort of like clarifying to say about that.
Well, the point that we have to make is that he acknowledges that it happened, okay?
Yeah, different from a lot of parties I can name.
Think about this. This is the Republican Party, okay? Yeah. This is the party, traditionally the party of the rich, the party of Wall Street, the party of, you know, although that's obviously been up for grabs quite a bit in the last couple of decades. But this is traditionally, this is the party of Herbert Hoover, you know, of Calvin Coolidge, you know, you go to Ronald Reagan and of George W. Bush. And it's an interesting thing, okay? It's a remarkable thing that it's basically, I guess you'd say now, it's leading intellectual or something. I mean, what would you call Bannon? I mean, he's the
I think that's fair right now. I think he's the lead. I mean, clearly Paul Ryan is being dragged by the nose, you know, by this guy,
yeah.
Like it or not.
Yeah, but he has a he's made a documentary about the financial crisis, about how it happened and how terrible it was. And for the first 20 minutes or so of it, so I watched it, and then I watched, remember Charles Ferguson's documentary
Inside
about the financial crisis,
job.
Inside
yes.
Job, which is, yeah. You know, I've also watched more than once, and that is a very credible account. I think it has some couple
yeah.
things wrong, but by and large, it's about 95% right.
Right,
and he talks to the right people. And he talks to, you know, people who were involved in the trades, people who saw everything happening. You know, he overlooks a few things here and there, but by and large, his experts are the kind of people that you would want. They saw what happened. And anyhow, so for the first 20 minutes or so of Bannon's documentary, which was made the same year, I don't know which came out first, but made at the same time, Bannon's documentary looks exactly the same. Not exactly. It's not word for word. It's not plagiarized or anything. What I mean is it's the same kind of stock footage, you know, images of New York skyscrapers, of money being counted,
yeah,
you know, of traders doing this and that. And he talks to a lot of the same kind of people.
So we're sort of starting on the same foot.
Yeah. And he acknowledges the sort of baseline facts. This happened, right? There's this housing bubble, and then it got transformed into, you know, collateralized debt obligations or whatever, mortgage-backed securities, and it almost brought down the economy. It basically did bring it down. If anything more alarmist than the Charles Ferguson version, than the mainstream version. But it takes me back. So I was writing for the Wall Street Journal when this stuff happened. And, you know, there was this scramble among people on the right to get out in front of this thing, because on the one hand, they were obviously to blame for it. This was the Bush administration had desupervised this industry, the Republicans had been – you know, deregulating Wall Street forever. Bill Clinton also, you know, did a whole lot of that, but with Republican help.
And the Bush tax cuts really poured fuel on the fire.
There was that, but you also got to remember what Bush is directly responsible for, it because he desupervised all the regulatory agencies. So, I mean, he filled them with hacks and cronies and people from the – so you had the SEC, just like the guy was – No one even knew where he was when the crisis happened.
Yeah. He was literally at a birthday party when the Bear Stearns bailout happened, and he wouldn't leave the birthday party. Wall Street Journal reported on this.
Yeah. And so, you have this string of Treasury secretaries and Council of Economic Advisors, people who don't know what they're doing and like have no idea, or they're from Wall Street, Hank Paulson.
Yeah.
These are people who had done everything in their power to let Wall Street do whatever it wanted. Okay. They had looked the other way while all of this crap was going on in the mortgage industry, scandal after scandal after scandal, and they hadn't done anything about it.
So what does Bannon say about this?
Okay.
How does he
this
deal
doesn't
with this?
Come up. Yeah. This part of it. But here, I'm sorry, I got off track here. So I was writing for the Wall Street Journal at the time, and there was this scramble among in right-wing world to get out in front of this thing. It's like, how can we blame this on the other side?
The great
how can
God
we,
failed.
How can we get – exactly. The free market, we let the market do whatever it wanted. And oh my God, look at what happened. And so how can we get out of this? And there's – all of these different ideas were thrown around. And Bannon's is one of those, and it really brought me back to those days. I had forgotten about, you know, so much of this sort of crazy blame mongering that these guys did. Anything to avoid talking about what actually happened, which was its massive deregulation of this industry, and that then.
Wait, so what's Bannon's explanation?
I just really want to know. Oh my God. So you're watching the movie and about 20 or 30 minutes in, and he's like, you know, but we know the real answer. The 1960s.
Wait, what?
A decade that's 40 years ago is responsible for what just happened. Yeah. So it gets a little weirder, because I'm also something of an authority on that, right? Because my first book is about the 1960s and about the advertising industry and the youth culture and all this stuff. And his take on the 60s is, let's say ill-informed. Okay, we're being polite these days. Are we being polite?
We don't
wrong.
Have to be polite.
Wrong is fine. Yeah, you can say it's wrong.
It's just wrong.
No, it's preposterous. No, it's just – it's not informed by actually reading any of the standard works of, you know, history or anything on he wants to blame the 1960s for it. How does he contrive to do that? He says, well, the kids were spoiled then. The parents spoiled them. So they had this generation that went to Woodstock, and they didn't understand personal responsibility. That's it. That is the extent of the argument. So he doesn't try to connect the dots between – like he doesn't show us that hippies – and he has all this footage of Woodstock, always footage of hippies dancing. It's like that's what they did in the 60s. I don't know if you're aware of this, Jason.
Yeah,
I don't know if you're aware of this, Mr. Carter. They danced.
I heard
right?
about
all
it.
The time. They were just like playing. It was like, you know, it was just like fun nonstop.
Yeah. 40 years later, credit default swap.
Exactly. Boom. You figured it out. And he doesn't make any effort to like trace.
It was all right there the whole time.
He makes no effort to trace, like to
the
say,
Stones
say Hank Paulson, who really is responsible for this more than a lot of other people. Hank Paulson was a hippie. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say Alan Greenspan, hippie. He never even tries. I would love to see someone try to make that argument. That would be fascinating because it's so false, right?
Just like, but it's at least fun.
But he doesn't even try. He just says the 60s happened. They had these bad values. And then a mere 40 years later.
We had a financial crisis.
Yeah. So therefore, the one caused the other.
But yeah.
That is the extent of his reasoning. And then he brings out all these experts. Who then agree with this?
That's some post hoc ergo proctor. What?
Put that guy in the White House. Put him in charge of everything. That, yes, I pounded on the table.
There we go.
Next
audio.
I'm gonna take my shoe off and pound on the table.
So here's the thing. This is crazy and wrong, right? But look, there are. It's interesting to me that you know we now have Donald Trump in the White House almost 10 years after the subprime stuff blew up, more than 10 years actually since the subprime stuff blew up. You know, there is not the story that you told at the beginning of this podcast about what actually happened is not necessarily like a common theme in the public discourse. And people are looking for some explanation for where things went off track. And I think – you know, for a while, people were like, well, it's the Kenyan socialist Muslim president's fault. You know, they're reaching for some explanation because they're not necessarily, you know, not everybody has a freaking PhD in economic history.
Well,
right?
Neither do I. I just read a lot of newspapers at the time. Well, I was writing for one, you know. It was my business. I had to know.
But you know, it's interesting to me that Democrats still don't really want to talk about this as sort of like a foundational moment.
You're skipping ahead to a point that I wanted to make later, but the thing is that when you look at these right wing explanations, and Bannon's isn't the only one. Glenn Beck was out there at the time.
Sure, yeah.
Glenn Beck really, I don't know if you guys sure you remember this. He really captured the public imagination in that really dark time. People were really scared. And he was out there, remember, every night on Fox News with his dose of fear. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And he was on the cover of Time magazine. He really caught the public imagination of this crisis moment. And the funny thing is when you and I who have studied history – I do have a PhD, but it's not an economic – okay, forget that. But you and I have read history and we understand that something like the Franklin Roosevelt administration and the modern Democratic Party exist because they – were the solution to the Great Depression. They came into power as a result of the Great Depression and as a result of complete Republican failure in the face of the Great Depression. You know, they couldn't do anything about it. Herbert Hoover sat on his hands, wouldn't do anything. Franklin Roosevelt comes in, the great Democratic leader, brings us the New Deal. You know, that's the story. And he succeeds and he turns the economy around and he gives us the WPA and he regulates Wall Street and all of these great things happen. And that is the foundation story or even the foundation myth of the Democratic Party.
Right. Yeah.
It's a true myth, but it is that is their foundation story. What you know, the Democratic Party before Franklin Roosevelt, you know, we don't even know about like Grover Cleveland. I mean, who knows?
We try not to talk about it, frankly.
Yeah.
There's some problems.
Yeah, but that is the Democratic Party. Okay, so where are they in all of this stuff when this is going down in 08, 09 and 2010 when Steve Bannon is making his movie? Well, it's Barack Obama on the presidential throne and he has appointed Tim Geithner as Treasury Secretary and basically Larry Summers is running the economic show out of the White House. And these are guys who are – one of them, Larry Summers, is a deregulator. This is one of the guys who is directly responsible for what happened. Tim Geithner is the guy that ran the bailouts from the New York Fed.
These
right? That has nothing to do with it. What I'm saying is that Obama, who should have been the Franklin Roosevelt figure in all of this, is instead totally compromised. And what's his narrative of the financial crisis? You remember what it was?
Oops.
There wasn't one.
Right. I remember a lot
he
of talk about
– He didn't want to talk about it.
There was a lot of talk in like 2010 about recovery summer and metaphors about getting the car
out of the ditch.
Remember the green shoots?
Yeah, but okay. There was all that about recovery. But what about saying what went wrong? Okay, this is like that's basic. That's fundamental. That has to come first.
I'm no gardener, so at first I thought green shoots were like parachutes.
Yeah.
I was like, what? I don't no green thumb here.
Is that like
a golden
parachute
only
kind of different?
Ignorant.
Yeah, like
I was like, what are they talking about?
For the age of ecology?
Yeah, I just didn't understand that at all. And then at some point I was like, oh, green shoots, S H O O T S.
He didn't have a narrative, an explanation, a myth.
Right.
And here's Bannon. And here's Glenn Beck, and here's all these other guys.
They filled
with
the space.
Like, it's the 60s that did it. And the great thing about the 60s, okay, the great thing, the thing that makes it work is that he is using the same explanation that powered the culture wars. I mean, it could have come right 1980s. Out of – who is that guy slouching to Gamora? Bork. Robert Bork, right? Or any of the great culture warriors
really
of the 80s and 90s.
It's really not too far away from what David Brooks says about, you know, title
changes. Yeah, but it has no connection to reality.
Yeah,
you see what I'm saying? It has no connection to reality. I mean, it does have a faint one. We'll talk about that. We're almost out of time, though.
We're almost out of time.
Well, hell. Okay, you got to read Listen Liberal.
Ragnarok
and there
approaches.
Is a faint connection to reality, but not in the way Bannon imagines it.
Right, yeah.
But he's got this alternative explanation that is – ideologically very powerful because you've got this conservative army out there that's like, oh my God, what went wrong? And he's saying it's Saul Alinsky and it's like, you know, they were Dr. Spock, right? All their parents were spoiling these kids back then. And they're like, oh yeah. And that's the same reason that we, you know, that we don't have prayer in schools anymore. And that's the same reason.
And why Clinton
that,
killed Vince Foster.
Yeah, that's the same reason that he, by the way, he never makes the connection between Clinton in the 60s, which you'd think is that's an obvious one, right? That's
if
like,
you're going to make this argument, it's a layup at least.
Yeah. there is, I think, unfortunately, in here an argument that the boomers really are a screw-up generation that wrecked the world, but we will have to leave that for another time. Thomas
yes.
Frank, so much. Thank you so much for joining us.
You got it, man.
Yeah, we will be right back. Hello, So That Happened listeners. I want to just take a moment to ask you to do a few small favors. First, if you like the show and want to help more people find it, go over to iTunes and just leave us a review. Every review we get bumps the show a little bit higher on the podcast charts. It does make a difference, and it's going to help us build this community. Second, are there issues you'd like us to address? People you think we should talk to? You should drop us an email at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. We really do appreciate your suggestions, and we often follow up on stories, and we just like hearing feedback and criticism. So we'd love to hear from you specifically because you're the people that matter the most to us. Now, back to the show. And we're back. So over the course of these many weeks, we've spent some time talking about the state the Democratic Party is in and what they should or should not evolve into in the face of Trump's successful presidential election win, and more importantly, Hillary Clinton's unsuccessful flat-out failure. We're going to talk about it some more. Joining us now is Zach Carter.
Hi, everybody.
And we are really pleased to welcome from the week, Ryan Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan, I want to just jump right into it. You have issued something of a cri de coeur this week, pretty much outright saying that if Democratic Party can't break off from Wall Street, they're pretty much doomed. Am I overselling that?
I think that's basically my argument. If you look at Clinton's margins of victory, places where she did really well were unusual places for a working class Democrat. She won Orange County for the first time since 1936.
Blew my mind. Absolutely blew my mind.
Upper East Side, you know, finance sort of cosmopolitan liberals. And conversely, she got destroyed in working class rural areas. Black and white or Latino did worse than President Obama in all of those areas. And so the way that I've been looking at this is thinking of her coalition as having some serious class frictions because they're supposedly, you know, they rely on black voters a lot to win many states. And so if you have that plus a campaign where you're spending half your time huddled with the ultra wealthy for campaign contributions, as Hillary was, you foreclose some of the policy that you would need to appeal to those working class and rural communities, because you know you are necessarily having to pitch your campaign to some extent. And if you look at, you know, the Democratic platform was pretty progressive, but the things that she tended to emphasize, it was like, oh, we can't have $15 minimum wage; it's got to be $12 because we'll be too radical. We can't have, you know, universal child allowance; we'll just have this marginally more expansive child tax credit that's very complicated to explain and model.
She kind of just pitched herself as, I will be a better manager of the status quo, which no one really currently likes.
Right. And we feel kind of guilty about all these poor people who are in our coalition. And so we're going to give them a little few nibbles of stuff that we could never pass anyway, but we'll put it in the platform. And so, you know, my attitude is just ditch the Wall Street stuff altogether. What Bernie shows is you don't even need their money. You can just raise a perfectly respectable amount to run a campaign on small dollar donations and appeal to the massive animus there is against bankers for their, you know, horribly unjust treatment and protection that they have received from the political class over the last 8 years.
You know, people don't want to hear it because the Donald Trump as he ran was many things. He was he stoked a lot of white nationalism. He had policies that are obviously rooted in bigotry, like his anti-immigration stance. But the truth of the matter is, I think that one of the things he pitched himself as quite successfully was something of a class traitor. He kind of indicated, yes, that he'd be a guy who would break up big, big, big monopolies of money, monopolies of power. I'm not saying that he's going to do those things as president.
No, absolutely established. Not. Obviously, he will not.
he's established a cabinet that looks kind of like that Wall Street party that Kevin Roos infiltrated way back in the day, that Kappa Beta Pi thing.
Secret society of billionaires.
Yeah, and let's not forget that one of his first actions we talked about the Muslim ban a lot, but one of his first actions was to make it harder for people to afford their home loans.
Yeah.
So there's obviously a disconnect in what Trump is doing versus what he was saying, but he pitched himself really successfully as a guy who'd bust up big power monopolies.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues here for the Democratic Party more broadly is that you hear a lot of calls for unity right now. And the calls for unity within the party, I mean, to some extent, they're coming from both the sort of Sanders wing and the Clinton wing. But a lot of them are coming from the establishment part of the Democratic Party, essentially begging the left part of the party not to make too big of a fuss, because we need to all stick together against Donald Trump. There was an interesting piece of reporting from Ed O'Keefe and Dave Weigel in the Washington Post this week, where a bunch of leading senators sat down with Bernie Sanders in a private meeting and said, please don't let all of these protesters primary us. Please tell them please direct them to Republicans, not towards us. And I just find that, you know, look, nobody wants to get primaried, so it's not that shocking that they would ask for
sure.
This. But one, Bernie can't actually control these people. The protesting is just happening, right? And two, you know, if what you really want to do is get Bernie on your side, maybe you shouldn't have an elective war against his DNC candidate, right? I mean, there's currently still a relatively bitter and nasty fight to determine who will be the next DNC chair that was just picked by the Clinton and Obama wing of the party after Keith Ellison was sort of decided upon as a consensus candidate, someone who had supported Bernie Sanders during the election, someone who Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid wanted to get behind, and someone who could sort of heal this wound from the primary. I just don't think they have learned what went wrong and what needs to happen as a result. I think they're looking at the Trump team kind of melting down at you know, General Flynn, as we were talking about earlier, being dismissed and saying, okay, actually everything we did was fine. It's just the Republicans cheated, and so long as they don't get to cheat next time, we're going to be fine.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sense that maybe there are some norms and antibodies helping to heal the body politic right now, but you can't just fight off the bacteria. You've got to then protect yourself from the infection. And I think that one of the big points you make in your piece is that Wall Street represents a different kind of infection.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you hear the Clinton people arguing that she won the popular vote. You know, so if there had just been – if Comey hadn't intervened, then she probably would have won, or a number of other things. But in terms of the general state of the party, it's in the worst shape since 1928, I believe, if you look at state legislature seats and governorships and such. And they need a committed activist wing to kind of counter the Tea Party like core, which is why the Republicans have been able to dominate during midterms and off-year elections, you know, stoke their turnout, which comes more easily from older conservative white people who vote in these sorts of things. And more than that, you know, Democrats have been deeply complicit in all this neoliberal deregulation and free trade policies and such that have, in fact, been horrible disasters across the board. You know, Clinton passed all sorts of deregulation and so forth, and it was a terrible idea. And so, you know, insofar as you think of politics as trying to actually cater to the material interests and needs of the people that you are serving in the democracy, Wall Street and, you know, the upper class writ large does not want the sort of things that most people in the country need, which is, you know, improved services, higher taxes on the rich, and, you know, no more huge financial crises.
You know, one of the things you laid out in your piece, Ryan, that I really thought was interesting was there's during the primary, there was a lot of talk about, well, is Trump explained by racism or is he explained by economic inequality? And it was a dumb question because the answer was yes.
it was a dumb debate.
Right.
Like the question could be posed, but the debate was pretty simple.
The fact that it raged for like 6 months was really pretty pointless.
Pretty boring, yeah.
But we now have a situation where we've got all these Democratic protesters out there, and you can see a pretty concerted effort by the party establishment to peel off all of the economic stuff from everything else that's going on. I mean, you saw Jennifer Palmieri on MSNBC a week ago saying, you know, look, these people in the streets, they're people who are protesting Nordstrom's and Neiman Marcus. They're not asking for $15 an hour as a minimum wage.
A ludicrous display.
Just really bizarre. And then, you know, this when Sanders tweeted out, you know, we cannot, you know, we have to be serious about Wall Street. A bunch of these people on Twitter, you know, these, you know, Clinton people were like, oh my God, you're talking about Wall Street while we have all these other bigger problems with Trump. Like, what's wrong with you? And I thought you made a great point in your piece that, you know, you can walk and chew gum at the same time here. And if you're going to talk about race being a powerful factor in the United States, you can't ignore the way that it intersects with economic injustice and the role that Wall Street plays in perpetuating that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Wall Street is up to its neck in all of the sort of structures that disadvantage minorities in American society. And black people in particular have been, you know, during the financial crisis, were before the financial crisis, that is to say, were specifically targeted middle-class black families with horrible high-interest loans. There's a court deposition where a Wells Fargo salesperson said that the shorthand was mud people, and they would give them ghetto loans that were deliberately terrible, even though they qualified for, you know, your regular vanilla mortgage, specifically because they're black. And as a result, the black-white wealth gap, which was already really big before the crisis, has gotten even bigger because of all these things that were handed out. And then after the crisis, the Obama administration's decision to basically stop enforcing the law regarding mortgages and to allow something like 9 million foreclosures to proceed based on documents which were systematically forged also harmed all these communities that are clustered at the bottom of the economic ladder, disproportionately black and brown, though obviously lots of white people as well. They got hammered by this. And you know, if you want to talk about racial, social justice writ large, you cannot ignore the role that Wall Street and entrenched power in general plays in this.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating things, I remember reading some old stats from like the Center for Responsible Lending in like 2009 or something. And they were saying most subprime loans to minority families were not, you know, the first mortgage. They were refinances. So somebody already had a decent loan that they could afford. They refinanced into an exploding piece of garbage, and then they lost all their equity. They lost their house. So like the asset, the middle class asset that they had their, you know, they had been able to get their hands on was just gone. It was just totally stripped out, and we just didn't really do anything about it. We just sort of let it happen, as you know, the federal government did afterwards.
The most interesting thing about all this, of course, is that, you know, I've talked about how in the past it's time for the Democratic Party to tell the professional class to take a backseat to these things. Professional class Democrats tend to have a collection of sort of liberal social pieties that they hew to. And I sort of think that if you're going to tell a group of this constituency that you're stuck with us, it's got to be the professional class at this point. Because where are they going to go? They're going to vote for Trump? It just doesn't make sense to me. I feel like what's happening right now in the streets is that ordinary people of all different walks of life who voted for all different people are very, very, very close now. Closer maybe than they've been before. Certainly closer than the Democratic Party has led them to be, to finding common cause with each other. And it was dismaying to hear Paul Mary try to get out in front of that and redirect things, because I think that right now they have an opportunity for something bottom up if they just sort of continue to forge the common cause that people are going out and fighting for right now. They're fighting Trump on all different fronts.
Paul Mary is not wrong that there are a lot of people who ordinarily aren't protesters who are out there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're trying to build a winning coalition, there just aren't enough Neiman Marcus shoppers to do it. I'm sorry. You cannot win an election with Neiman Marcus shoppers. That's what inequality means. There are no people at the top.
Yeah, yeah. They just don't have the votes to do anything else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this – a lot of times you hear, you know, leftists will talk about how – you know, you hear something like this and you're like, this is the revealed preference. You're saying, you know, people don't want $15 an hour because you don't want $15 an hour. And you're trying to like quash this broadly popular thing to protect your sort of class position or whatever. But I think, you know, this was the real case against Bernie that the liberals are pretty squishy about, was that if you nominated him, you would bleed off a bunch of rich liberals who would vote their pocketbook and go Trump, or you'd have Mike Bloomberg get in and try to split the vote to throw it to Trump. But I think the number of people who would actually do something like that is pretty small.
Super remote.
Number one, because, you know, Republican Party is horribly racist. But number two, you know, there's all sorts of things you can do aside from $15 an hour sort of, you know, a poverty policy that would benefit the way, way up into the upper middle class. You know, try having a kid in this country as, you know, a family making $150,000 a year. It's really hard because of our crappy welfare. There's, you know, universal social policies would benefit everyone. You know, Bernie always talks about basically everyone below the top 5%. And that, you know, you could totally build a coalition out of there. And there would be a little bit of frictions, but, you know, say like, where our fast food workers are getting $15 an hour, but, you know, middle class people are getting access to decent, you know, child care, paid leave, and universal health insurance, you know, the safety net that also catches you if you happen to lose some income or something like that. These people they're totally wrong footed in the political moment, and they're just repeating the same things that they've always been saying for years.
I think that, you know, there's always going to be people who reflexively vote Democrat. There's always going to be people who reflexively vote Republican. If there's a lesson to take away from what we saw in this last election, it's that what moved a shit ton of people to the polls this time out was the fact that they're all in the party of desperation and they're looking for something, anything to change their way of life and their fate right now. And Trump won those guys. Trump won them. And going back to sort of Wall Street chicanery is not going to help bring them back to your side. Ryan, it was a great piece, man. And we're really glad that you came on to share it with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And we will be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Zach Young. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we are joined by journalist and author Thomas Frank, The Week columnist and reporter Ryan Cooper, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Jessica Schulberg. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Please check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, you can send us an email at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We miss you already.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.